Welcome to the Seattle Kitchen Show on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. I'm Chef Tom Douglas.
And I'm Katie O.
And our chef in the chapeau is on his way, but it's going to miss our first segment, it looks like. I just wanted to say hi. I've just been at the farm.
Whoa!
Telling you.
What's happening there at this time of year?
You know, we have a farm in Prosser. I just want to say thanks to all the folks who came over for our open house last Saturday. It was really fun. I was cooking salmon and pork tenderloin on focaccia with a little Prosser Farm pepper relish and some chipotle mayo made with avocado oil and a little spicy arugula.
I wish I had known about this. Tina, don't you wish
everything,
you had known about this?
Yeah, where's
everything
my invitation?
Toasted over a wood fire. It was really good. You guys really missed it.
I am feeling like the event we did.
Yeah, exactly. I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, including this cooking school that we're taping our show in, the Hot Stove Society.
Mm-hmm.
We are doing this. We do it here every week. If you want to join us on Tuesday mornings, is our typical taping time. You can just go to hotstovesociety.com and buy a ticket. For $15, it comes with breakfast and hot coffee.
Ooh, the coffee is good this morning.
Is it? Are you liking
it? Very good indeed.
On today's show, you know, we're here for 2 hours, so on today's show, we're going to head to Darby Winery in Woodinville to squish some grapes and drink some wine. Did you do that, Tina?
Certainly did. It was a blast, and I brought some wine to share with all of you.
Did you get a few grapes between your toes?
My feet were purple for days.
Really? Yes, they didn't make you wear socks or anything?
It was really fun. No.
Wow.
No, it was like Lucy and Ethel style.
Did you shower first?
I did. I dipped my feet in some clean water.
Oh, okay.
But then you get pretty grubby, and they process it.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Just checking.
Extra flavor.
We're gonna clean and prepare crab with Captain Sean Dwyer of the Deadliest Catch. You know, he came in that first time, and we had so much to talk about that we did a second segment and taped it a week or two ago when he was here, but about how to clean king crab, of which I had a fine version of last night. At Ray's Cafe. When was the last time you ate at Ray's Cafe?
You know, I haven't been there in a long time, but I certainly have fond memories of going.
Yeah, I think it might have been 8 or 10 years for me since I had been there. So, just saying. It was just perfectly
good. It was a delicious little salad.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing you have to do to king crab except buy good
crab,
right? And then you have to thaw it properly.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to let it slack.
Mm-hmm.
And then... you know, just don't overcook it because you'll drain all the liquids out of it.
All the goodness.
But we'll hear more about that from Sean Dwyer. We're going to share our tips and tricks for buying and cooking pumpkins.
Something I never do.
Why not? Which part?
You
must buy a pumpkin like for a jack-o'-lantern for
I guess on an occasional I'll get festive and carve out a little jack-o'-lantern, but I never think about actually
purchasing. So what you're saying is you steal them.
I steal them. Yes.
Don't tell the authorities. You do steal
them. I just never really tend to cook with them, so I think that's going to be a fun segment.
Yeah, I love cooking with pumpkin. I think it's an underutilized squash. And, of course, we're going to do our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. Because I feel the need for speed.
Do you think you're going to win today? Are you feeling
confident? I'm not feeling like a winner so much as I'm not feeling like a loser.
You're middling now.
Yeah, I'm middling.
That's good.
I have confidence, but not over. Some days I come in just feeling like
coming in hot.
Yeah,
coming in hot,
exactly.
Tom Douglas. Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. There's a lot of show between now and then. A lot of good stuff,
mm-hmm.
And then we'll see how you're feeling by the time the quiz comes up.
Are you suggesting you're going to smack me down during the show, and I'll be a puddle by the time the quiz?
Maybe I'll ask some really hard hitting questions.
Okay,
and
good.
Throw you off your game.
Speaking of hard hitting questions, let's jump into ordinary to extraordinary because the chef in the chateau finally decided to join us.
Yes, my goodness. Perfect
Bonjour.
Timing. We know that he loves to make things extraordinary. So let's just kick it off, shall we? Beef stew. It's starting to get a little brisk outside. I imagine the chef in the hat here would do a beef bourguignon, perhaps.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it great? A little dash of...
No. How do you take an ordinary beef bourguignon and make it extraordinary?
Right. That's what I was going to say. What makes it extraordinary?
That's what he was going to say, Tom.
What makes it great, as in extraordinary? So a little dash of vinegar at the end of your warming up your bourguignon. Spruce it up a little bit. Lots of fresh herbs on top. Fresh parsley is my favorite thing to put on the bourguignon.
Mm-hmm.
And some wonderful grilled bread drizzled with olive oil. So you can dunk that in there. And definitely have a fabulous time with that.
I will add to this, Mr. Chef in the Hat, to your retro, is that you gifted me some cherry vinegar. I want to say it was last year. And I was braising some beans. And I was like, this could use a little perk. could use a little something something. And I did exactly what you just outlined. It was delightful.
Did it work good?
It's one of those acids in stews. I think vinegar at the end really helps, making it, you know, just spruce it up a little bit.
Tom,
now,
any thoughts?
I would also say that sometimes people think that they can use a better cut of meat to make it better. Like, if beef bourguignon is good with a chuck roast, it must be really good with filet mignon.
Right.
No.
And it's really a bad idea.
It's a terrible idea.
Terrible idea.
So just stick with that nice bone-in roast and do the cooking method better, right? Low and slow. And
make sure you sear your pieces of meat before you do the stew. Make sure you put all your marinade back in, your red wine, and then a little stock if you have some, and then bring it to a boil and then put it in the oven and cook it, you know, very nicely, slowly, so all the meat tenderizes.
That's right.
Nothing like a nice piece of beef that melts in your mouth with a little red wine sauce.
Good connective tissues to break down there. All right. How about, Tom, you take this one, acorn squash.
Yum. Well, my mom made it perfect. You know, my mom did the whole, where she cut it in half and, you know, put the hollowed side, took the seeds out, put the hollowed side down into a pan of water and baked it and then turned it over and put massive amounts of butter and
that's what makes it
brown
good.
Sugar in there. And it was just like a...
You just made it extraordinary.
It was just like a candy bar. But that's kind of the classic way, right?
Right.
I think that's the way we had it. I'm assuming it was similar.
Kind of reminds me of that era of like glazed carrots. Like everything kind of had this like sweet candy-like quality to it.
So a little toasted almond and some citrus grated on there.
That would help. Or
that would be delicious.
Scoop it out and make a pâte choux.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
You know what a pâte choux is?
Yeah.
Cream puff dough?
Yeah.
Take half pâte choux and half acorn squash.
Make
meat,
some gnocchis.
Make them, mix it together and make some delicious little pan fried gnocchi.
Yeah.
Really good.
Wow.
That
so you just
crumptious.
Give them a little sear in butter and pop them in the oven and let them puff
little,
up.
Little sage.
Like little pillows, little sage butter. That's one way to take something that's ordinary and make it extraordinary.
I got to tell you. That sounded pretty extraordinary. I wasn't sure where you were going with that, but I'm convinced.
Well,
I'm
are you going
convinced.
With me now?
I'm totally with you.
You look like a fashion model today. Your hair's all poofy.
Really?
Were you not trusting him to come up with something?
No.
Nope.
Speaking of trust, we're going to answer your questions on olive bars, restaurant specials, and more when we come back on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. I'm Tom Douglas.
I'm Terry Roger, the chef in the hat.
And I'm Katie O.
It's nice to have our audience motivator back with us.
That's right. It's lonely.
We're here for 2 hours. Again, we have a large show, but don't miss the Food for Thought Tasty Trivia, because there's some feelings about it today.
Yeah, a lot of
feelings.
We have questions. Speaking of feelings, I have questions from our lovely listeners.
That's
and
right.
So we like to answer them as best we can.
We do our best. Mm-hmm. You actually do your best. I don't tend to answer these very often, but I try to speak on behalf of the people vis-a-vis our Facebook page, Seattle Kitchen. If you have a question for any of us here at the show, even Tina, our producer, maybe Sarah as well, feel free to ask. The first question comes
from... What
question
would you ask, Sarah? How does it feel to hang out with Tom and Terry and Katie?
Well, tell us about your journey between not knowing us to knowing us, and how has that affected you in the kitchen? Okay. Does that feel hard-hitting
That
enough?
Should be about 2 second answer.
Yeah, she's like, I feel okay. Things are okay.
What kind of appliances did you have in your dorm room the first year? Like a toaster oven under your bed or blah, blah, blah?
That's what you would ask?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I bet she could answer that off air for you in a second. Let's ask you some questions, however, from Facebook. The first one comes from Barbara Kendrick. She says, I have heard that you should not order the special from a restaurant as it is just a way for the kitchen to get rid of old food.
She must have read Kitchen
is
Confidential.
Is that really true or just a myth?
She must have gone to Lule or Luke, because we would never do that.
Oh, my gosh. We can't say anything about other establishments.
That is ridiculous.
That is
ridiculous. Special. It's an opportunity. I'll say oftentimes. I can't speak for everyone, but for us, you know, it's an opportunity. You get something in last minute. You got a farmer walk through your back door, piece of type of fish that you're not usually don't have around, and it's not going to be around long enough to put it on the menu.
Mm-hmm.
So it's it's often the best thing in the house.
Yeah, I mean, it's often exactly, and it is also, you have to remember that the menu is printed, and chefs are pretty much like little mad scientists. They love to play around and do something different
and
new.
Right.
They get bored very easily because most of them have ADD.
Well, it's not just that, but let's just say crepe cakes. We're well known for crepe cakes at the Dahlia, say. And we've had them on the menu now for 29 years.
Right.
And you can imagine in the kitchen when they've made 70 orders of crepe cakes tonight that the special is...
It's refreshing.
It's refreshing.
I think it actually feels special to the
kitchen
staff.
That's why it's called a special.
It doesn't make the crab cakes any less special.
No.
But to the chef, it's something different.
Correct. And, and you know, the Gachos up at the back door, he's got a beautiful, I don't know, sturgeon from the Columbia River. The chef is like, totally, we're going to use that as a special and make something really special. And you should look at a special as something special, not as something fearful.
Well, like I said, that's how we feel about it.
Yeah, in Kitchen Confidential, there was mention of, like, never go eat seafood on a Monday because it's left over from the weekend. And you know, this is all-day stories, you know, and there are some crummy restaurants everywhere.
I was going to say, I'm sure that there are some restaurants.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you love a restaurant and it's always been reputable, it will continue to be reputable.
In the Puget Sound, we have enough talent and enough good cook who care that the special is definitely something I recommend.
All right. Let's move on to the next question. This comes from Janice Hawkins. Question, when I buy olives at a fancy olive bar, should I make sure to include liquid in the container? Also, how long do they keep? I think that's a great question.
We on the brine. You have to take the brine with you. It allows the olive not to dry out.
Mm-hmm.
It also allows them to stay longer in your refrigerator.
I say no.
No.
No, they're already brined. Why pay for the brine? Get more olives.
You're not paying for the brine.
Yes, you are. It's sold by the weight.
It's sold by the weight. I would also say...
Put the brine in a small plastic bottle you brought with you.
And put it in your purse.
Only check in the olives at the counter and then put the brine back with the olives.
Yeah. I don't think it's super important if you're setting out a cheese tray for that night. They're going to be fine.
Even for a week in your fridge.
Even for a
week,
they're
hydrated and they're fine.
Yeah. Buy enough for what you need.
Chef and I just disagree on that.
Okay. Next question, Michael Johnson. I have a question for the chefs. I make a dish that I call Cheap Man's Chicken Alfredo. I use top ramen and cream of mushroom soup and mix in some pan-fried chicken. How would you make it better while staying inexpensive and quick?
Okay, it doesn't have to have ramen to be cheap, but you can boil some noodles and really make a
good... Yeah, but the ramen comes with that nice powdered flavor.
Exactly.
So full of umami.
It's that sauce.
Which is 90% salt.
Exactly. I would recommend just making some nice boiled noodle and using your chicken with that. Even put a little creme fraiche in there and you'll have a wonderful similarity to Alfredo, and then grate some cheese on top of that and you'll have a wonderful pasta with your chicken.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with the ramen.
I weirdly...
You do.
Is it strange if he made this for me, I'd be like, I'll give this a shot.
The thing I would change maybe... Did he say he put mushrooms in there? Or just
cream of mushroom soup.
Yeah. I would probably get rid of that. Just go with cream and then use a nicer mushroom like shiitake.
Yeah.
It has a good woodsy flavor.
Even if it was the dried kind, which was so much cheaper, it still would be a more...
Yeah, but why bother rehydrating? Yeah. Although that could be a way to enhance your cream sauce.
Mm-hmm.
So
I said just make some nice pasta yourself. It doesn't cost more money. It's a matter of money, it's not more expensive to boil water and have pasta. I mean, it's...
But what's wrong with the ramen noodles?
Well, it's just, why?
I mean, 25 cents a portion is pretty cheap.
The whole dehydrated stuff is nice, but no, thank you.
Plus, it's been deep fried, and me too. I like that seasoning.
The chicken's already dead. You don't need to kill it again.
Well, I don't know. It's got its charms. All right. Alonzo wants to know best recommendations for fall food. I find it difficult to transition between the brighter, fresh foods of summer and the hot roasted veggie soups of winter. What is in season and works well for home cooks at this time of the year?
Well, any sort of squash is in season. We're picking our winter squash right now at the farm and doing all sorts of things with them. I mentioned making gnocchi out of them earlier. Certainly butternut squash soup is a very popular, super easy soup to make.
And a batch soup, which means you make it for the week. You don't make it for one meal only.
Yeah, or freeze portions of it.
Right.
You know, two-person portions.
And nuts are very big in season right now. So, you know, you start having all the hazelnut and walnut from the Oregon and Washington, and those are big and coming in season. And then
Shamefully, I haven't been to the farmer's market in the last couple weeks. Can you still get corn? Is corn still available?
It's not. Well, no. You can still get it, but it's not good right now. At least not that I've had.
Yeah.
Season's done.
We're done with tomatoes. We're done with corn.
Tomatoes are still around. We still have two fields of tomatoes left that are slowly ripening. Yeah, as the nights got colder, they just kind of stopped.
Well, this is a green tomato time of the year.
Maybe a fried green tomato sandwich.
Peppers are still going strong. eggplants are starting to wind up. I was just over there, so I happened to see, like, we still have cucumbers mm-hmm. coming off the vine.
The weather has been nice. But
we have 2 weeks left of some decent produce.
Eastern Washington goes overnight, and it
but apples and pears.
Yeah.
The whole valley reeks of Concord grape juice.
I love that smell.
That mixed with the hop aroma that's going on. All the kilns in the valley are working mm-hmm. right now, drying hops. It's incredible.
And there is only a few weeks left, so it's going to go quick after that.
Sop it up while you can.
Mushrooms are in season and coming up strongly, so another thing to add to your soups. Sauteed chanterelle, sauteed mushroom, wild mushroom, cauliflower, all that stuff mm-hmm. roasted and added to your soups. It makes a nice garnish.
You know I keep in my pantry are those little bags of dried mushrooms that you buy in the produce department.
Yeah, those are delicious.
Little porcinis or, you know, I tend not to buy morels because I don't think they have enough flavor, but probably porcinis I use the most. And I just think that whether you're making a stuffing like for your turkey,
lots of flavor.
Just using that as kind of a base or even the juice and mince it for a gravy of beef gravy, a pot roast, whatever. I love having that in my pantry. I think that's a super convenient item.
It's an easy flavor bonus that you can add to anything. Yeah, it's very cool.
Very much like anchovy paste, right? Where you put it in and it adds a layer of flavor that once everything else is done, you don't really recognize that it's there individually, but it adds to the base of flavor.
I would agree. Yeah. That extra layer of savory deliciousness.
All right. Those are the questions we could get to today. The James Beard Foundation's having a Taste of America dinner. It's coming back to Seattle. I know Brittany Bartleben from the Baker's Corner is going to be doing a pastry for that, part of their pastry segment. So we're going to talk to Dick Stevens about that. He's hosting that again or working that event again. So coming up next on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. It's the Seattle Kitchen Show right here at the Hot Stove Society. Thank you so much for being in our room with us, for listening. We're podcasting. You can find us anywhere on the net.
Everywhere.
Everywhere on the net. I'm Tom Douglas, owner of several of Seattle's fine restaurants, and Dick Stevens of Varsity Communications is joining us here to talk about the the James Beard Taste America Seattle version, which is October 19th at the Fairmont Olympic Hotel down there on First Avenue. So I just did an event down there for historic Seattle.
No, the Fairmont is not on First Avenue. It's on
The Fairmont Olympic.
University
I'm sorry, I said the wrong. I'm sorry. I got married at the Olympic Hotel.
I know. That's a special. That should be, obvious for you, tender moments.
Anyway, Dick, welcome to the show. Tell us what's going on with the James Beard Foundation.
Well, it's always great to be here. I kind of feel like the James Beard season gets kicked off when I get to be on your show. So thanks for having us on here again. You guys are the godfathers of the James Beard movement here in Seattle. So it feels fitting that we get to be on the show here with you guys. It's exciting. It's the fifth time that we've been able to have James Beard Taste America in Seattle. And they continue to pick 10 cities every year that the foundation feels make up the culinary fabric of the year to come. And it's an honor for
the 20
city.
Years ago, they were not even looking west.
Isn't that funny? And now it's very west.
No, it's all west.
You guys blazed a trail, and I think that all these people and all the roots of the tree of Seattle and Portland are really coming through now. I mean, when you go back to the awards and you go back to the boot camps and you go back to the James Beard House, people are always asking about what's happening up in this little dark part of where we live, and it's exciting to put together a night that shows that off.
So which so-called celebrity chef is going to join us this year to kind of lead the show?
Yeah, so we always bring an out-of-town all-star mm-hmm. to marry with our local all-star, which you guys have both been local all-stars for us. Our out-of-town all-stars are exciting. It's Stuart Bioza and Nicole Krasinski from San Francisco. They're both winners, and they own State Bird Provisions mm-hmm. and a restaurant called The Progress. And it's exciting to see how they want to integrate into what we're doing. But a lot of times we've had a national all-star who's come from not even the West Coast. So it's really kind of neat to have somebody that's West Coast-based mm-hmm. that understands what we're trying to do here. We had a great all-star last year with Ashley Christensen. But I'm really excited to work with Stuart and Nicole. And Stuart's going to be working mostly on the main course, which is a very special pork dish. And Nicole is not going to just help him, but also she's going to make a very special dessert because that's where her star shines the brightest. So she's going to be part of a dessert reception, which I'll talk about in a second, which is different for us. But our local all-star, And Terry and I were there to watch lightning strike this gentleman twice in 25 minutes to have Eduardo Jordan join us as our local All-Star when he could easily be a national All-Star.
Did he rack it up this year?
Oh, my gosh. It was so great. We were lucky to get him signed on as our local All-Star the week before the awards. I had a feeling he'd win one, if not two. And we're really elated to have him because the national attention on him has been massive, right?
I mean, yeah. Really, and he's a fine cook, so that's... That's really, at the end of the day, what you're hoping for, right, is somebody who can just kick it in the kitchen.
Totally, and he's got a great story to tell. Mm-hmm. His food is familiar to people. It's comfort food, and both those restaurants, you know, being 500 yards apart there in Ravenna, it's just a fun story to tell. We continue to talk about Eduardo and a lot of the press that we're getting. So those are our two all-stars.
So you have a three-course dinner that night.
Three-course.
And you buy a ticket? Is that how that goes?
So we're sold out. It's gone gangbusters. So. Now, I have held a seat for each of you gentlemen if you want to come and be VIPs and just enjoy the evening.
VIPs? Oh.
Yeah.
We're showing up.
VIPs? Yeah.
VIP.
Well,
we're
very
showing important up. People, yeah.
This is going to be the first time for me. What about you?
The seats have gone nuts. We've sold it out about a month before the event. I think people are just constantly excited about showing off Seattle. Right. So 320 seats have gone, both for the cocktail party and the dinner. But we still have availability for our celebrity chef cooking demonstrations at Sur La Table in Kirkland on October 20. That's Saturday. We have a 10 o'clock and a noon cooking demonstration. These are free of charge. If you go to jbftasteamerica.org and surf through to Seattle, those have no cost. We want anybody who would like to come and attend to come watch those guys in action.
And what are they cooking? Do you have any idea what they made for dinner, maybe? Or
the menus are going to be released this week. Forbes is going to do a national release of all 10 cities' menus, so that's an exciting element. So I'm going to wait just for the big surprise to be popped per the foundation.
Oh, but we're having special pork for Minkos.
I kind of cheated there a little bit. I did tell the pork part. We have to have some meat on the table, but it's really a snapshot. What is cool is we have different chefs involved every year, as you guys know, and we try to pick chefs that can bring a real picture of the Northwest. And our local all-stars are just as exciting about what we do at the cocktail party. So we have six different James Beard recognized chefs during the cocktail party, which is 90 minutes. So Jay Blackington from Hogstone Wood Oven, Graham Cockburn, who's one of the James Beard recognized chefs now cooking on the Windstar Cruise Line, which is based here in Seattle. Felipe Hernandez, who really brought the house down, the America's Classic winner from Union Gap, Washington, who makes the tamales, has been another cool thing to talk about.
Stop there all the time on my way to the farm.
You know, it was great to see somebody win the America's Classic from Washington State, but somebody who prepares a meal so simple and so beautiful. Those guys are going to be great. They're part of the cocktail party. Melissa Miranda is also a part of it with Musang. And then Shota Nakajima and Mutsako Soma from Adana and from Kamenegi to come in and really show off that we're a Pacific Rim destination for food. People should fly in to see what's going on here, in addition to your guys' great restaurants, to show off that we are global, we are diverse. So I'm excited about the new chefs that we've got lined up for the cocktail party.
That sounds good.
And you have, I know, our very own Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery, who is often a guest here in the Baker's Corner.
Yeah.
Is going to be there doing the dessert, part of the dessert buffet.
Yeah, Tom, we're so excited to have Brittany in there. The dessert piece is different. So usually dessert is the fourth course for dinner, and we bring that to the table. This year, we, after the third course, are going to flip the room while dinner is being served in the Spanish ballroom. We're going to have the foyer turned into this incredible three-station dessert reception where Brittany is going to be showing off her abilities, and then artists from the Fairmont and Laura Piles from the Pantry. And then we'll have a couple other special elements that are going to be surprises. But the cocktail reception, the dinner, and now the dessert reception have turned into another element of the night, with special cocktails being crafted by our friends at Whitford Reserves. Pardon?
How much does it cost to get a ticket?
It's sold out.
But
it was $295 or $395 to sit at a celebrity table. And we had a couple special packages where the tickets went a little bit more, but it's very affordable for what you're considering, getting.
I mean,
and
that sounds like a big event night, too.
It really is. All the money that is being generated, Seattle was one of the top revenue makers for the charity for James Beard. It goes to the impact programs. All the work that the foundation does on full use of food and the chef boot camps and fairness in the workplace and all the diversity things. I mean, there's something going on every day now with the foundation if people follow it online. And that's where this money goes. It's mm-hmm. really exciting, and it's an important part. Taste America has really turned to be a prime mover for the foundation and their outreach. So mm-hmm. it's going to be a great 2 days for us.
Exciting.
It's interesting, considering some of the more famous chefs around the country have been, busted, I guess, for some inappropriate behavior. And I think it's really kind of shown on the restaurant industry about what not to do and mm-hmm. how to be a better industry, a more thoughtful industry. And I think that it's really great that the Beard Foundation is kind of getting behind some of the efforts there for more awareness and more reasonability in the kitchen. And the good, idea good that Gordon Ramsay is the role model on TV for young cooks makes me crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think...
Me too.
Yeah. I mean, would you ever want to work for that guy? I like that we're promoting. We're talking about Eduardo Jordan, who's a sweetheart. We're talking about these many young women chefs. I know we're part of their mentorship program for women chefs in the industry, have been for 3 or 4 years now, I want to say. Super program. It's really helpful to get women chefs all the way through the process and not drop out of the process
mm-hmm.
through
well, and also
intimidation
feel supported,
or interrogation.
Right?
And feel supported. I mean,
I think
all the way through the management level, yes. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they're doing a lot of good things. I think the foundation is more than ever. In the beginning, it was just really about the awards, but now I feel like they're really taking an active
right.
role in our industry, and it's awesome.
They have shifted to a very great place, so it's good. Yeah.
Well, I think that they see themselves as an opportunity to create awareness. And Terry, you and I were both at the awards, and we saw the theme that I rise for mm-hmm. equality, I rise for right. sustainability, whatever it is you rise for. And the foundation is exciting right now. New leadership, new people involved. It's cool to be a part of it, the grassroots, and to play our small part here in Seattle in the Northwest. So we're really elated.
It's not
about
a small part, Dick. It's a big part.
Well, thank you.
It's a big, big part.
It's important to us, too. It's an honor to be a part of it and to move the needle for the foundation and for awareness. Seattle's got so many great things to talk about.
All right. Dick Stevens of Varsity Communications, thank you. The event is October 19th at the Fairmont Olympic. There are still some tickets available for the October 20th free cooking demos at the Sur La Table in Kirkland. Just go to jamesbeardfoundation.org would be my guess. And you can find out more about that. Up next, how to pick the perfect pumpkin on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen Show. It's Tom Douglas.
And Terry Rotorola, chef in a hat.
And Katie O.
And Katie, earlier in the show we talked about you being unsure about pumpkin maybe
yes.
cooking it.
Yes,
but also not even buying them. You tend to like to steal them. From the front of the store,
you know,
where they're mounded
that.
Up.
You wait till people carve them nicely, and
that's
then you take them.
That's my little secret. Okay, we can't just tell that on the
You've
radio.
You've been the
show.
Best pumpkin carver forever, but
yeah,
you've never
exactly.
carved a pumpkin.
Yeah, that's what I do. I look for the nicest, best carved
no,
pumpkin
I'm
on the
just
street.
Kidding.
Yeah.
Never do that.
No, but I really don't ever. I mean, I love buying acorn squash, butternut squash, spaghetti squash sometimes, mm-hmm. but I don't tend to think about buying a pumpkin and then cooking said pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm interested.
When I was a child, we didn't have the many different squashes. I discovered squashes in America more than in France. But we definitely had pumpkin, and that's what we ate for like probably 3 weeks in a row. That's what we had, those big orange pumpkin.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have Halloween. We didn't celebrate Halloween. That wasn't part of our culture. But we definitely ate pumpkin.
Yes.
So tell us about that.
So the best way my mom would make it was always the same, which she would boil it, make a soup, very thick pumpkin soup, mm-hmm. and then a dash of vinegar. Remember I was talking about vinegar earlier?
Mm-hmm.
My dad would always put the bottle of red wine vinegar homemade on the table, and then you put a dash of vinegar on that,
uh-huh.
and then some toasted nuts, hazelnuts was the thing that would go in there, and that was the soup. You started with...
And was that dinner, or was that a beginning soup?
That was, in where I come from, soup is like the first course of
okay.
any dinner.
Mm-hmm.
300 days out of the year, you have soup to start.
Ah, like my family, it was rice with everything, unless we had spaghetti, in which case, no rice. But
right.
Yeah.
No, we always had bread.
So let's go back to the pumpkin. How did your dad know it was ripe?
Did he
knock on it? Did he shake
it? Yeah, they would just look at them and they go, okay, well, we got about another week on the pumpkin. You know, he would knock on them.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he was listening to because I was a kid and I was like, what is he doing? Because I'd go like this, and I'd go, well, that sounds good. Bang, bang, bang. You know, you hear the noise. And I wasn't quite sure what he was looking for. Obviously, I changed that because I learned how to listen to the pumpkin. But as a kid, I didn't know. And he would say, okay, another week. And then a week later, my mom would start picking. And those pumpkins were probably like, you know, the size of a soccer ball. Bigger than a soccer ball. And then she would cut them, and she would peel them, and she would put them in boiling water. Mm-hmm. And then
just in chunks.
15 minutes later, you'd have a soup. She'd blend the whole thing up, and then we'd have a soup puree for the rest of the...
Now, how would you change that, going back to, say, our ordinary to extraordinary segment, now 40 years later?
Yeah, I mean, I've
so
learned...
So would you roast the pumpkin instead, so it caramelizes and dries out a little bit?
I would definitely caramelize it, because I think it adds layers of flavor. Mm-hmm. We always talk about how do you make things from ordinary to extraordinary, or better. You know, I think boiling is great, but roasting adds a layer of flavor you don't have originally. And there's plenty of sugar in pumpkin that there's a nice caramelization that happened then. I like to put a little olive oil, salt, pepper, maybe some fresh nutmeg right on top of that, grated nutmeg right on top of that pumpkin, and then roast it that way. And then blend it, and you have this wonderful puree.
So blend it with what? Are you a cream blender, or are you a chicken stock
blender?
No,
I'm not a cream pumpkin. I'm much more of a stock pumpkin kind of guy. And then at the end... a nice little nugget of butter or some fresh olive oil, and then finish with one of those two. But a little fat at the end, yeah.
Now, do you take the seeds out and roast those and serve the seeds or not?
You know, I've had that many times. I'm still not a fan
of... It's not your thing.
It's not my thing. I feel like, you know when you talk about oats being horse food? I feel like seeds are like horse food. Like you're chucking on something that's, okay, whatever. I don't feel like it adds much to my life, so... Mm-hmm.
That's so unlike you not to use the whole pumpkin.
I understand, but I used the meat, and the skin is useless, and the seeds, well, you know, I got chickens. I got chickens around my house. I give them the seeds, and that's going to give them some nice yolks.
There you go. That's a good That's a good way.
That's how I would recycle.
Can we take it back a little bit in terms of, let's say, any of our listeners are going to a grocery store, and usually there is a huge display of pumpkins out front. Sometimes you have just kind of the regular old... jack-o'-lantern pumpkins.
Which are not good for cooking.
Which are not good for cooking.
Stringy and gross.
But you might find yourself at somewhere like a market that has kind of that variety of pumpkin. They have kind of those ghostly white ones and little small guys, and they really just vary. So if you're approaching that display and you want to cook with a pumpkin, what are you looking for ultimately?
Well, for me, the bigger is not the better.
Okay.
You know, in pumpkin, you have to... look at your pumpkin, and you have to feel like there is something in there, like meat is in there. Because some pumpkin have, you know, they're huge, but they have like 1 inch meat inside only,
right?
A layer of meat. And it's like, well, there is not much meat in there. And that meat, in bigger pumpkin, that meat's going to be tough.
It's a bit like, I think of like an oversized zucchini. Just because a zucchini is big, it's not.
Or even melon,
really,
you know,
great.
If your melon was the size of a, you know, was twice the size of a soccer ball, you know you'd have a melon that would be overripe on there. And overgrown. So it's kind of the same idea. Pumpkins can grow really big.
Mm-hmm.
So not necessarily the bigger the better, but a nice hefty weight on the pumpkin.
Yeah, you want
dense,
them to be, feel
small.
Heavy for their size.
Yeah, you want to feel heavy for the size, exactly. You want to feel like it's full in there. Like I mean, obviously not full, but...
I would also just do a little research on edible pumpkins, and that would give you an idea before you get to the grocery store.
Right.
But certainly the sugar pies, we've grown them for years out at Prosser Farm, and... we roast them all along with butternut squash for our Thanksgiving pie mix.
Mm-hmm.
So I think mixing pumpkins and squash gives you a little bit different layers of flavor. But the pumpkin itself, I like small ones. I like to cut them in wedges. I like to caramelize them, you know, roast them with olive oil and caramelize them. You don't even have to skin them.
Yeah.
I think they make a beautiful base for a salad, like a little caramelized pumpkin with some... a grilled radicchio and goat cheese and things like that.
Grilled radicchio.
Are really a fun fall and winter time salad.
Yeah, and you can actually, you know how you take a melon and you just cut it in four, a small melon.
Yeah, like wedges.
And then you can take your knife and run your knife through the pumpkin meat and make cubes. Don't take it out of the skin, but just make the cubes like this. Roast it like this, so when you eat it, it's just little cubes and you're taking out of the skin.
Well, how convenient is that? That
sounds very
delightful.
Practical.
They're still mushy, though.
You
got to use a spoon or something. So that's what I would do. Oh, the other thing I would look for are those heirloom pumpkins that are kind of squatty and gnarly looking, mm-hmm. and can often, I think, be delicious.
Oh, interesting.
The Kubota squash looks like a pumpkin, a green version of a pumpkin.
Right.
Super fun texture, great for deep frying.
Yes.
They make beautiful tempura.
So good.
Look for all the different varieties. And again, I've said this a million times, but when you go to a produce shop or stand, find a place where you feel good.
Yeah.
Find a place where you connect with somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And literally, if they're good, they will slice open that pumpkin for you, set out a little squash tasting for you, eat it raw, see what tastes good to you.
Yeah.
And then go from there. But you got to support them, and they'll support you in your quest for the best pumpkin.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And other people probably want to see what's inside of that pumpkin, too. So you're doing everybody else.
But it's the same thing with an apple or a pear. You can go to the guy and say, what's your favorite apple right now? And he'll just walk right over and cut his favorite apple. Mm-hmm. That's what good produce stands do.
Exactly.
So it's no different with carrots or celery. If you go to the grocery store now, there's five different kinds of carrots.
Right.
And most of them are not that great. But I would tell you that...
Spoiler alert.
Just because they're pretty and because they're heirloom or because they're small does not make them good.
That is true. That is the same with tomatoes, I find, as well. Don't be fooled.
Just because they look nice doesn't make them taste good.
That's right.
That's always what I say when I refer to coming to America from a farm in France. And you come to America and you go to a vegetable store and every vegetable is exactly the same and lined up and looking gorgeous. And I'm like... How the heck did they do that? Because the carrots I picked in the last season were totally there was not one that was straight, and they were. It's very interesting when you grow stuff, you realize that it doesn't look like what's in the store.
Up next, Captain Sean Dwyer of The Deadliest Catch is back. We're going to talk about how to clean and prepare king crab that he brought right here to our kitchen on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. We're back in the Seattle kitchen. We're lucky enough to have Sean Dwyer here.
Captain
from the Deadliest Catch show. What's the name of your boat?
My boat is the Brenna A.
The Brenna A.
Yep.
Lovely. I'm going to assume that's somebody you know.
It's my sister, Brenna Adele.
Oh.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Hey,
yeah.
Sis.
Great singer.
Yeah.
This is part of our Seafood 101 month, and we're continuing. Last week you told us a little bit about how you catch the crab and all the economics of the crab, the sustainability of the crab. This week, let's talk about the crab themselves, because without a marketplace, it doesn't help you to catch any,
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
So you've brought these enormous crab legs.
Ooh,
right?
They're beautiful.
Pound and a quarter, pound and a half. You've shelled some of them. So some of the main, what do you call that part of the legs?
We call them sections.
Sections.
So, they're sections of the legs. And that's the upper portion nearest to the shoulder of the crab
mm-hmm.
is always the biggest. And on some of these pieces, it's over 6 inches.
Over 6 inches long, yeah. And a good half pound right there of meat.
The most beautiful legs I've ever seen.
That part of the crab is the best. The legs have the most flavor because they're always working. They're always crawling across the ocean floor.
And they have texture, too. I actually like the body meat, too, that kind of white end of the shoulder area.
I'm sure if you use your crab cake cookbook, you can throw some of that shoulder meat in there.
Into that frittata. We have a king crab frittata in that in that book. So when somebody goes to the grocery store, Sean, and they just want king crab, and they're going to get not necessarily the best.
Right.
What are you saying?
Okay, so you want to make sure you're asking for Alaska Red King Crab.
Okay.
That's the biggest and the best. And then next to that is your Alaska Golden King Crab, and that is the second best product out there. But you want to make sure that you're asking for Alaskan crab. That's mm-hmm. going to be your best product. And then as far as sizing goes, if you want the big legs and claws, they're called jumbos.
Jumbos.
Yep. Yeah. So that's what they're labeled as in the wholesale market, mm-hmm. and so that's what you're going to want to find. There's different sections. There's 12 to 18 ounce clusters and sections, but you want the jumbos.
But it's not like shrimp where you can say I want the 16-25s. That gives you an average size shrimp.
Right.
These you have to say jumbo or I want the claws.
Yeah.
About the word maris? That comes up all the time.
Yeah, that beats me, man. I don't know.
You don't know that one?
You got me.
What is
curveball?
That's the curveball.
I don't know. I know somebody knows.
I've never heard that, Tom.
Oh, so the audience member says it's a piece of that's what this claw meat is called. So
there you go.
Now, do you ever see king crab shellless? I mean, like Dungeness crab, you can buy by the pound just the meat, but you don't really see king crab that way.
Yeah, sometimes you'll get what are called splits, where the shell has been split in half long ways, and those are really great because they're super easy to clean.
Right.
But generally, if you're seeing king crab meat, it's from the shoulder of the crab because it already comes out kind of shredded when you shuck it. But more often than not, you're not going to find that in a grocery store and at your local market. You're just going to find legs and claws.
Right.
Now, we know on these boats that there's chefs on the, there's cooks on the boat.
Yeah.
Do you ever eat the product?
Well, you know, I mean, every once in a while we'll try one out. But we don't that often because if, imagine, you know, so crab has to be cooked immediately after it's killed and butchered because you got to keep the meat fresh. And having a boiling pot of water on the stove in the Bering Sea,
it's not good
a little bit risky sometimes. So maybe on the way into town, if it's nice and calm, we'll crack one open. And, of course, we'll record it for our state and federal bodies.
Good.
It's called Stuff Meal.
Yeah.
We're talking with Captain Sean Dwyer from the Deadliest Catch TV show, and I'm talking about king crab. You see Ophelia crab and other Tanner crab. Do you catch those at the same time?
We do. We catch Barrett Eye, Tanner crab, and then we also catch Opelio, also known as snow crab. Opelio is the smallest of the Alaska crab. Barrett Eye in the middle, I think, honestly, the best tasting. And then king crab is the biggest the most gorgeous looking.
You guys call it crab. I believe this is what we call sea spider in France.
Yeah. Arraignée that's essentially what they are, right?
Yeah, that's what they are, because they don't have any claws, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I know them as a sea spider.
Mm. So chefs, I would say we've gotten great tips so far about how to purchase this. And once you've purchased it, what would you then do with this beautiful product?
So I'll take the first part of that, and then you take the second.
Sure.
First part is typically when you purchase it, it's frozen.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So now you can't mess it up from here. They've done all this work to get you this beautiful
crab.
It's already cooked. Do not mess it up by putting it under running water, right, and washing all the flavor out of it.
Don't do that.
You have to let it thaw naturally. And then, in my opinion, when you reheat it, you're just reheating it gently to a warm. You do not want to heat it to a hot.
Correct.
Or all that seawater and all that crab juice will just bleed right out of it, and you'll have
a stringy
crab. Okay, Chef, now it's your turn. What are you going to do with
make
this
a wonderful,
beautifully slacked out crab?
I would make a basic beurre blanc, which is white wine, shallots, thyme, reduced down, little white vinegar, finish with butter, lots of it, because that's a butter sauce. Mm-hmm. And I would just use that as a base. Jump in some basil in there, some chopped basil, and then with that as a base, to just dunk in your warm king crab in there, and it would be unctuous with a nice little glass of probably Sancerre, a good Sancerre, you know, Sauvignon Blanc, nice minerally.
Can we do that later today?
Yeah, Captain Sean's like, wait a second.
Is this an option?
last time I had a king crab was with Eric Ripper at Le Bernardin. I had a 5-course lunch with him. Then we went into the kitchen, and they just literally had steamed this fresh king crab.
The live one, yeah.
And we ate like most of it after a 5-course lunch. I was like, because we just kept talking
eating.
Oh, yeah. You can't stop.
Yeah.
Especially, I mean, this is one thing that I was going to ask. On the market, it comes frozen, like Tom said, in the market, in the store. It's very hard to get live king crab.
It's very hard logistically to get live king crab. It's just hard to move that product from Alaska and forth.
Right.
So. Back on your recipes, we've also got some Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers genuine recipes on our website, Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers.
Are you saying we're genuine?
Did you?
Well, I mean, you know, you want it straight from the fisherman. There's some good recipes on our website, Alaska Bering Sea Crabbers.
How long does it take to cook a crab like this? Because you just boil it,
when
right?
it's boiling, it's anywhere from 19 to 22 minutes, depending on the size and the water temperature.
Yeah. See, I would do it for less.
Well, you got to get it far enough, and then you got to blanch it real quick to get the meat to suck away from the shell.
Right. Got to get it off the shell.
So, and shucking it. There's a little bit of a technique to cleaning the crab.
I watched you over there. I just learned something. October is National Seafood Month, and to celebrate local fishing organizations, the Port of Seattle and the Seattle Propeller Club have joined together through Seafood 101 to celebrate this and encourage folks to eat more seafood. And king crab is one of them. Make sure it says Alaska Wild on the box?
Alaska King Crab.
Alaska
it's all
King
wild.
Crab. Yeah. Then you'll know it's a more sustainable choice that you're making. If it doesn't say that, you don't know what you're getting. Okay, thank you, Sean Dwyer. We are back in the Seattle kitchen. I'm Tom Douglas, and I'm here with friends with mouthfuls of breakfast sandwiches.
So good.
What are you having today, Miss Katie O?
You know, I got the vegetarian that had mushrooms. They were beautifully sautéed, and surprisingly, there was some delicious goat cheese, like an herbed goat cheese and radicchio.
Mm-hmm.
Delightful.
Me too.
Full meal. Delicious.
Young Tina, you have been off to Darby Winery. Tell us a little bit about your adventure.
Yeah, you know what is wonderful about this time of year, this fall, is A, the light is so pretty and the colors are so beautiful. And when you head over to Woodinville, Washington, there are so many delicious places to taste and experience wine. I was lucky enough to head to Darby Winery, where they were crushing the grapes.
I was going
to
say, it's harvest time.
Yeah, and he actually has people come in and crush the grapes with their bare feet. I got to experience
this could make a very interesting vintage.
You know what's funny about it? You know, Lucy and Ethel is what I always think of.
That's what I think of, too.
Right. I love Lucy. Yeah, it is kind of like that. There's big barrels, and you get right on in, and your feet get pretty gnarly, but it's super fun, and it feels like you're kind of part of the winemaking process. Uh-huh. So I thought it was neat that he's still doing this tradition. Not a lot of winemakers are still doing that, but he is. So I got to experience it and learn a little bit about how Darby started making wine, which was for his neighbors in his very own basement.
Darby English, and I'm owner of Darby Winery. Started making wine in my basement in West Seattle in 2001. So I took the hard route of doing it and doing it myself. So I worked my day job and made wine in my basement. And luckily, I befriended some winemakers that were just getting started in Woodinville in the early 2000s, like my good friend Mark Ryan and a few other really successful guys, and kind of saw what they were doing and wanted to be a part of kind of the wine culture. So started making wine in my basement and fell in love with the whole process of creating something. And, you know, kind of as the neighbors started asking for a little bit more wine, then I figured I might as well start selling it. So we went commercial in 2005 and did about 400 cases of wine. So we did 250 cases of really good Syrah and about 150 cases of Viognier Roussanne, and then opened a tasting room in Woodinville in 2006. So it's changed a little bit since then, but we're happy we started kind of when we did. We do about 4,000 to 5,000 cases, depending on the yields, because with Mother Nature, on a hot year like this, they'll give us a little bit more because we'll let more fruit hang out there. So yields will be a little bit bigger this year, but we're in that 4,000 to 5,000 case range, which is kind of where I want to be. You know, it's kind of that life balance for me. I like to work hard, but then I also like to go fly fish a lot, so, and hang out with my daughter. So it's kind of that we're going to stick at the 4,000 to 5,000 case range for the foreseeable future and just keep it fun. You know, I'm one of those winemakers that I still here getting my hands dirty. And at this stage, there's a lot of other winemakers that have hired winemakers and now they're running the business, which is fine, but I didn't sign up for this to run the business. I want to still make wine and go to the vineyards and be in part of that. So if I go past 5,000 cases, then I have more employees, more warehouses and all that stuff. And I just don't want to do that. When I was making, you know, 400 cases, I kind of knew that I was just going to make wine that I like to drink. I wasn't a big white wine drinker. I had to do research, which was pretty fun to do, drink a lot of different white wines and figure out what I liked. And I love the Rhone stuff. So I love Viognier, Roussanne, Marsans, and found a really good source for some Viognier and a little bit of Roussanne, and then figured that I'd just make some of that. And I knew I'd have enough friends and family that would at least buy half of it because they like to drink a lot. And just went from there. Just kind of, you know, the first couple of years, it's kind of nice because you can afford to do that and figure out, you know, what you like and what you want to make and figure that people will buy it. But, you know, since then, we've had to look at other varieties that I may necessarily not be my favorite, but we have to make because I know the people out there, you know, that's what they consume. And I've since actually like Cab Franc and a few other ones that I didn't like before since the fact that I've had to make them. So pretty much 90% of what we use is really good French oak. French oak is just a little bit better, in my opinion, than American oak, although American oak is making some vast improvements. It's just a little bit too strong for the style of wine I want to make. But we do use some American oak for something like, say, Petite Syrah that can handle that. So you have to figure out which wines like different types of oak, and there's different forests in France that we choose for different wines, different coopers or producers. They're all made by hand, and these guys are artisans, so they make little fires over each individual barrel, and then they move it by hand over the fire to actually get the toast level. So these are really handcrafted barrels, and the French oak is just really, really subtle, and we use probably about 50 to 60% new French oak on our Bordeaux stuff. We also like to have neutral barrels in here, too, in case it gets a little oaky. Then we can add some of those neutral barrels back in the blend to kind of tone down that oak influence in the wine and get it to where we want it.
You know, it's interesting. The last time I crushed grapes with my feet was at the Italian Festival at Seattle Center, which was every year. I don't know if that happened this year or not. I didn't hear much
about it. Festal. I think it's called Festal.
Yeah, Festal d'Italia or something like that. So anyway, that's the last time I did that.
We're out here crushing wine with our feet, literally.
Yeah.
Is that a common thing out here in Woodinville, or are you one of many?
I'm not sure. I think a lot of people do whole cluster, like foot stomp with Syrah and some Rhone stuff, but I think a lot of wineries maybe get lazy and they don't do it, because as you can see, it's a lot of work. And maybe some wineries don't think it makes a difference, but in my experiments, I know that it makes a difference, and I think I like the old school. They do a lot in the Rhone Valley, and I can just taste the difference, and I've done a lot of experiments on doing it and not doing it, and it turns out really, really good. It's kind of hard to put into words, but if you taste the difference, you can really tell. It's just a kind of mid-palate. There's much more complexity to it. It may not be as dark and kind of as big of a fruit bomb as people are used to in Washington, but it's going to drink much more European Rhone-like, which I'm kind of going for. And I think we can get a lot of that stuff through just fermentation techniques and making the right decisions and picking the vineyard and those type of things.
Where are we going to find Darby? Is it grocery stores, restaurants locally, or?
Just a good mix of grocery stores, you know, Whole Foods, Met Markets, all the little wine shops around. Restaurants, we're in a few good restaurants. And our tasting room in Woodinville here. I mean, if people haven't been out to Woodinville, we encourage them to come out and taste. It's really fun to come out on the weekends and bring friends. And we're not we're distributing in New York and D.C. and a little bit in Austin, Texas, and a little bit out of state. But I think we're focusing on Northwest. People love Washington wine and Oregon wine, so we're going to focus just on selling it here more than any other place.
So you brought us some wine. Now, please be clear that this isn't the wine you've been stomping in.
Oh, Tom, you know very well that the wine that I was stomping in is processed enough. It's going to be the most delicious vintage.
And we
probably.
Know, and we know
so
you
intimate.
Get clean feet, too.
I do. No, we are drinking Darby's native rosé wine, which is quite delicious. And if you see the bottle, it's got salmon on it, because he is concerned, as we all are right now, about the salmon
population. Sure, here in
yeah.
the Sound. And so, is it raising money for any particular cause?
Yep, it goes to an organization. I'll let Darby tell you all about it.
Yeah, so it's a really cool wine that we have called Native. A good friend of mine who's a local artist called Casey Underwood did a really awesome label for us. And then 10% goes back to Wild Steelhead Conservation. So I'm working with the Wild Steelhead Coalition on this, which is a great group of guys and you know, really good fishermen as well. And we all like to go spay cast and swing flies for wild steelhead on the Washington-Oregon coast. But the counts of steelhead have been really down the last, you know, 10, 15 years, and it's getting to a point where somebody needs to do something about it. You know, and working with the coalition, they were excited when I approached them, because they were looking for ways to get the message out there, and it's hard for them. They do a good job on social media and on their website, but this is just going to be kind of the random person that sees this wine and reads the story on the back might, you know, encourage them to donate and to get involved in this. So we're really excited. We have some really popular restaurants kind of picking this up, and that are, you know, they're fly fishermen and they want to support the local cause, because people don't know that, you know, steelhead's the Washington fish. So you should get that out there. But no, we're super excited about this brand, and I think it needs to be done. And it's just, we're just getting started with this too. So we have a Native club too, which is going to be a really awesome wine club. So we're doing, for $35 a bottle, you get 6 bottles or a case a year of Red Mountain Cabernet. So typically those wines go for $40 to $60. We're going to make it $35. And that way, 10% goes back to the Wild Steelhead Coalition. So you're not only getting great wine, but you're giving 10% back to the coalition all in one shot.
A super fun weekend with Darby at Darby Winery. Hey, if you don't want to make it all the way out to Woodinville and you live close to Seattle, keep your eyes open, because Darby will be opening a wine bar soon in West Seattle. Coming up, Brittany Bartleben's back in the chef's corner, and she's sharing her favorite speedy recipes, desserts you can make in under an hour. You're listening to Seattle Kitchen on Cairo Radio, 97.3 FM.
Welcome back to the Seattle Kitchen. It's time for the Baker's Corner. Chef Brittany Bartleben from the Dahlia Bakery has joined us. And earlier in the show, we heard that you're cooking at some fancy James Beard event
up
here in a few weeks.
Up.
It's already sold out. Did you know that?
I did not know that.
320 desserts you have to make.
I do have to make 300. Yeah.
And there's only 3 dessert makers, which means there's going to be 107 people in your line in a heartbeat.
Yep.
Just saying.
Yeah, I'm ready.
So what are you making?
So Woodford Reserve is one of the sponsors, and so I, of course, jumped on that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm making a Woodford Reserve bourbon toffee cake with a green apple butter and cider jellies, and I haven't quite put everything together yet, but it's going to be just fallish and delicious.
Are you taking one of your team with you?
Nah.
How are you going to put all that out in 10 minutes.
I might take one of the marketing gals with me.
I remember the good old days. Yes.
You know what it's called?
Marketing. Different payroll.
Yeah.
My payroll is fine.
Yeah.
How's yours?
All right. So today's subject, we gave you a little advance news on, is speedy desserts.
Speedy desserts, less than an hour. Yep.
And you probably don't get to make these very often because everything you do is fancy.
Fancy, and you know, there's elements that I start one day and finish the next. So usually I'm making speedy desserts if I have to make dessert at home. And my go-to is clafoutis.
Clafoutis?
It's just, I'm sure Terry and I can bond over this dessert. Yeah. But it's one of the those desserts that I always have all the ingredients for. It's butter, milk, sugar, flour.
Eggs,
and then whatever fruit you have lying around in a baking pan, and you've got it on the table in under an hour.
Is it just a thick crepe batter, basically?
Exactly. It's a thick crepe batter. It's like a flan idea with flour in it. It's a very simple recipe to make. It's very hard to screw up.
It's so hard to screw up.
I mean, it's not, you know, you can't.
What about when you put the cherries in with the pits?
Is that so that's traditional,
that
actually.
I know.
That's how my grandmother used when I was a kid, we never, ever ate a cherry in a cake or in a clafoutis. It was never, ever pitted.
Is that just to get you to slow down, or what's the reasoning behind
it? It's because my grandmother was like, you pit your own damn cherry.
Grandma hasn't done enough work.
We are the only country in the world where fish have no bones, chicken have no feathers, and fruits have no pits.
We like things done for us.
It's kind of like,
what
do we have 32 teeth
for? The pits themselves have this wonderful almond essence to them, and so that actually perfumes the batter while it bakes. So I get, you know, one, pit your own damn fruit, and two, it actually adds to the flavor of it.
Absolutely.
Plums as well. I've heard if you get a little plum, then you just leave the pits in.
Huh. Like the Mirabel, if you get Mirabel, oh my God.
Those Mirabel plums?
Yeah, those little yellow plums. Uh-huh. Oh my God.
That's
those
special
are delicious.
Season. Yes. A special, special season.
It's good with frangipane too.
What about peaches? Do you just put the whole damn peach in there too?
It's just giant.
comes up about a third of the way on the peach.
There's one quarter of your peach that's cooked, and the rest is like whatever.
I will say I always take the pits out if I'm using a stone fruit and clafoutis. But right now, what I'm really loving is apple clafoutis. We're getting these wonderful Gravenstein apples in from Newaukum Valley Farm, and I'm just shaving them on a mandolin. And so when you do that, you can pack them into your dish. I mean, I can get like 2 pounds of apples into a 9x9 square
dish. Delicious, nice, big, dense bites of apple.
Yeah, yeah. And so when you pour your batter over it, when you slice it, you can actually get a nice, clean slice. It's just gorgeous. Yeah. And
one little trick is when you do layers like this of very thin fruit is to put a few layers, just like when you do a gratin, you put some of the batter in between, you know, after a couple of layers, so there is a little flavor in between the apples, and it helps cook the fruit as well, and it's delicious.
Yeah, it basically looks like a potato gratin, but it's absolutely fantastic.
I'd like a whole night of just things that look like potato gratin or are potato gratin.
Yes.
Start with a potato gratin,
courses,
move to the apple clafoutis, and then take a really long nap.
Maybe I'm just slow, or as we know, I am slow, but when you layer your apple like that so densely, doesn't your clafoutis batter bake like way before you actually get the apples cooked into your pan?
So that's why I shave them so thin on a mandolin, or you can just use a really good sharp knife. I mean, we're talking,
it becomes steaming to start with as opposed to baking.
Uh-huh.
Because number one, when you bake the clafoutis, I mean, the outside becomes all baked up. You know, it's like a nice crust, nice top.
I understand.
Nice,
I get it. But if it's on top of 3/4 inch of thin sliced apples that are packed in, how do you get the heat through that before the top burns?
Well, no, the top won't be burned. And if you have when you're baking, you can attest to that. One very simple matter is if your cake or anything becomes a little bit dark before it's finished to cook, put a piece of parchment paper on it and you'll be safe.
Yeah.
The heat will not be impacting the top like this and caramelizing.
I haven't found that's happened to me with as long as I slice the apples really thin. And I do like that little bronzed lid of caramelized sugar on the top of my clafoutis.
Well, it has to be.
Too.
I mean, the clafoutis needs to have that beautiful brown crust on top.
All right. Yeah. All right, another quick dessert. No bake bars.
Yeah, those are great. Any cookie, an Oreo or a ginger snap or even graham crackers, you're just going to grind those up in your food processor with a little butter. And if you want to add a little sugar, That's fine. Little pinch of sugar. And then I always add salt. And then you just pack that into a pie dish or a sheet tray if you want to do a bar and just give it a quick bake in the oven. And then you can
Wait. It says no bake bars.
Oh, yeah. I guess I'm a liar. 86 that crust. Okay, no bake bars.
Well, no, yeah. It's okay. But if you're doing that, then you just bake it for a little bit.
Exactly.
Like
we're
a shortbread.
8 minutes. Yeah. I mean, we can spare 8 minutes in our under an hour dessert. No bake bars, however, I don't think is a great dessert to do in under an hour because it needs to set up.
Okay.
And so you need like overnight for that.
Ice cream sundaes are a given. That's
given.
Easy.
Banana splits.
No.
Oh, yes. Those are fat. Oh, this is
so good.
So
nothing
delicious.
Nothing like an ice cream sundae or banana split.
Yes.
You know, just
yes.
a traditional banana with ice cream.
What about pudding? Because I often, when my mom made pudding as a kid, when she made homemade pudding instead of like Jello pudding, it would be warm pudding. She
yes, like rice
warm,
pudding.
Never
or,
seen
yeah,
that anymore.
Or warm chocolate pudding. Oh, that's another
pudding.
One.
Mm.
Rice pudding's a great one. Mm-hmm. It's so comforting, and that's another one. I prefer to eat it warm.
So you just take a creme anglaise and do whatever you want to it and put it with...
Cook your rice in
rice,
it.
Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Is there a better rice to use for a rice pudding?
Arborio is a really good one.
Like a risotto rice.
Yes,
jasmine
exactly.
rice is good,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, jasmine rice. It's kind of whatever your...
Whatever
your palate.
In my house.
I've made it with wild rice before, and it's actually very
Ooh,
nice. That
seedy.
Takes a while, but
uh-huh.
yeah,
mm-hmm.
it didn't sell because people don't want wild rice for dessert.
I would order that so fast.
I love rice pudding, but I'd be like, if you say white rice pudding, I'd be like, no.
I would order that so fast. I love that kind of thing. Just like I like that. Like 6 or 12 grain rice bag that you can buy at the Lodge of Maya.
That's
something.
For savory, but not for rice pudding.
Why not?
But Tom likes a savory sweet situation. Mm-hmm. Like you like a buckwheat crepe as opposed to a traditional just plain flour.
Less sugar. Yeah, I like a buckwheat crepe too, but not for dessert necessarily, more for savory.
Well, that's because you are so French.
Well, speaking of quick desserts, crepes. Super fast.
Probably faster than a clafouti. You just have to stand over the stove for a few minutes. And actually, crepes were one of the first things I made. Like, I was probably 11 or 12 with one of my friends. We were making crepes all day. And, you know, at the end of the day, we've consumed like 10 pounds of powdered sugar. But yeah, so fast, so easy. And a little bit of fruit, little whipped cream, total crowd pleaser.
That's your favorite, just a little fresh fruit whip. What about Nutella?
Yeah, Nutella. I mean, when I was a kid, my mom would put we had three things on the table, whipped cream, Nutella, and jam. And man, you make crepe with jam, you make crepe with Nutella, and you make crepe with whipped cream. Ooh, that was delicious.
Nutella's fine.
And then this time of the year, you've got pears.
We have a little dissension in our
group.
Yeah, no, I heard that.
Everybody hates me for this. I'm not the biggest Nutella fan. I don't know why. Everything about it I should like. I'm getting so many glares right now.
There used to be, there was like a hot Instagram trend there, because sometimes that's where you see these kind of pastry trends, where people would make just a huge stack of crepes and then make them into basically
a cake
shape and then cut big slices of it. And I'm not a huge Nutella fan either, frankly, but I could imagine doing all sorts of fillings in that. That would
apple
be really
butter
delicious.
Is a really good one to use for that.
Apple butter.
This time of year is a great time to just throw a pear in some poaching liquid, little wine, sugar, water, some spices, and just slowly let that poach. It'll be done in under an hour. Little ice cream, done. Yeah. So delicious.
Or you can make your own marzipan, which is really fast, right? You can make a pine nut marzipan or pecan or anything.
Yes.
Even frangipan, too.
Frangipan.
Just buy an almond frangipan.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I'm a big fan of Tom's pine nut marzipan, I should say. I'll take that over Nutella any day of the week.
We'll see.
Well, there you go.
Looks like I can do something.
You win some. You win some in the second.
Frangipan over Nutella. Marzipan over Nutella. That's pretty good.
Yep, absolutely.
I'll take both.
What is? I know it's German, right? Marzipan started in Germany, but
I think so.
In Europe, it is so popular.
It's everywhere.
Yeah,
and you either love it or you hate it. I love it.
Really?
Yes, absolutely delicious. Yeah.
Okay. If it's done right, it's really delicious.
Yeah.
All right, that's what we have from the Baker's Corner. That's Chef Brittany Bartleben. She is the queen of all things sweet.
I like that. She's a sweet queen.
And up next, we have Food for Thought Tasty Trivia on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The Seattle Kitchen Show from the Hot Stove Society. We're going to wrap it up today with our Food for Thought Tasty Trivia. And Chef Janet Bell from the Hot Stove is going to sit in today.
You three are going to go head-to-head, 5 questions each. I want to just say that this week's quiz, all the questions were provided by Geeks Who Drink. They host trivia nights at bars nationwide, including the Brave Horse Tavern. You can find a trivia night near you at geekswhodrink.com.
And it's funny because Janet was like, I hope we're not doing this gig for whatever.
Are you a little bit more nervous now that you know who
made
this
quiz? Were you not here the last time that we had questions from these guys?
I was not.
It was devastating. Well. Tom cheated at the end and got an audience member up to help him because Terry and I had done so poorly.
You know, in America, lobbying is allowed. So
I just bribed them with a $25 gift card to our gift shop. That's all.
It could happen again.
Maybe
today.
You shouldn't be so cheap.
I should have whispers from the audience.
Yeah, whispers from large, loud whispering going on. As I said, each of you will get 5 questions. Whoever gets the most correct wins, and whoever gets the least amount correct loses, and they have to give something to one of our listeners. This week we're playing for Michael Johnson. You may remember him earlier in this episode when he wanted some tips on how to make a cheap and cheerful Alfredo. He was the gentleman using Top Ramen cream of mushroom.
We should buy him a case of Top Ramen.
Hats off.
I'm going to tell Michael, since he is so cheap, that I'm going to give him a $100 gift card to Cuoco restaurant over there in South Lake Union.
He can have fresh homemade pasta.
Fresh homemade pasta for free. Because he was worried about the price. So.
Yeah, have a night out, Michael.
Cuoco, we make our own pasta all day, every day.
And I'll give him a brunch for two at Luc, where he can have a delicious onion soup. Another way to use your onions and your water.
I had that soup the other day.
You know how to make a soup.
It's delicious. Janet?
So if I lose, I will be giving 2 tickets to a class at the Hot Stove Society on Tuesday, October 16th, 2 weeks from today, for lasagna with Chef Bridget Charters, tickets for 2.
Wow, that's a $170 value, right?
That is $180
value. Hello!
So, she's pretty generous when she's not her own money, isn't she?
I know. Right. Aren't we all? Can't we all just be generous when it's not ours?
All right, let's get this show on
the road. Let's do it. Terry Rotrow, you love to go first, so these questions are for you. Your first question. Besides the screw-top salt shaker, John Landis, something also invented, what glass jam containers with detachable lids?
Canning jar?
The answer we were looking for is Mason. Mason jar.
Yeah. Oh, is that his last name? Hello.
Hello. Let's try question number two.
All right.
No to drugs, yes to calories. Apple Brown Betty was the favorite dessert of what film star turned first lady?
Nancy Reagan.
That's correct. True or false, Terry
Rotrow? The only first lady I know.
Yeah, well, and she had a war on drugs. True or false, the bacteria that causes foot odor can be found in Limburger cheese. Is that true or false?
You probably would think that when you smell the cheese. I'm going to say false.
It's actually true.
Oh, my God, that can be.
Next time you get a whiff of something funky, check the cheese drawer or check your neighbor.
Dang.
Or your toes. So
what
your mean, personal toes, that's right.
What it means toe jam is
there is a guy who walked in that cheese originally because otherwise it would never started that way.
Who knows? Who knows what's going on there?
A guy with bad toes walking to the cheese.
All right, Terry, your fourth question. What is the main ingredient in baba ganoush?
The main eggplant.
Eggplant is correct. And your final question, what do you get when you ferment a mixture of honey and water?
Mead.
Mead is correct. Terry Rotrow, that's 3 out of 5.
That was a good comeback.
Nice comeback, Chef.
Nice comeback.
I can't believe I missed the Mason jar.
Yeah, well, it's a little tricky.
I was going to say ball. So
well, I had it right in the canning jar.
I was thinking ball.
I was thinking wep because I think it was maybe French.
That was Lucy ball.
No.
All right, Janet, are you ready for your questions?
Oh, I guess.
Okay, your first one. The main ingredients of hummus are mashed chickpeas and what other pasty spread?
Tahini.
That is correct. Round sesame seeds. Thailand's red hot and spicy rooster sauce is better known by what name?
Ooh, Thailand.
Red hot spicy rooster sauce.
Ooh. Sriracha.
That's right.
Hey.
The Swiss cheeses Gruyere and Emmentaler are traditionally components in what communal dish?
Well, I guess I would have to say fondue.
That's right. Well, come on, Janet. Don't play coy. I know you've had some fondue parties.
I always thought
parties.
That was raclette. No, that, I take that back. I know.
Raclette is its own special.
Janet's smoking it today.
Yeah, she's really. Don't stop now, Janet. Your fourth question. What fancy entree might you find in a modern-day U.S. military field rotation? Eggplant parmesan or lemon pepper tuna? Which fancy entree might you find?
Ooh, no idea, but I'm going to say...
Is that like an MRE meal ready to eat scenario?
Yeah. Something. Hmm. I'm going to say the tuna.
Yeah. That is correct. Lemon pepper tuna.
Yeah.
Wow, Janet. Okay, your last question for a perfect score. Your fifth question. Regular Chili's patrons know that you go right behind the spine to get what tapering cut of pork ribs?
Baby back?
That's right.
Oh!
I love that baby back.
That's awesome.
Oh, boy.
Janet.
So much nice for my earlier boast.
That's right.
See?
And she was all nervous about it, but really, she just
now you like geek,
it.
Huh? You like
those
geek,
I think those geek guys after the last debacle.
All right. Tom, your five questions. Your first one. What fattening Canadian snack consists of French fries topped with cheese
poutine.
Curds and gravy? Ooh, that's right. Poutine, that's your favorite. Your second question.
I hate it.
I know you do. I was
it's right up
just
there with cottage cheese
joking.
And banana splits.
Them's fighting words. Web
alert.
Them's is fighting words. All right, your second question, Tom.
I especially love it like 10 minutes after it gets to the table and it's all coagulated and gross. Ugh.
Yeah.
It becomes something else through alchemy. It's no longer just...
Yeah, death on the table is what it
gravy.
Becomes.
Sometimes I kind of like that.
We're going to have a few emails
like
about that one, Tino. Be ready.
All right, Tom, your second question. Don't get Gordon Ramsay started. A proper beef Wellington is made with what soft... fancy steak cut that runs under the sirloin.
A filet mignon.
That's right, the tenderloin. Your third question. What Midwest staple food gets its name from the French word for saucepan?
Midwest staple.
For saucepan.
Terry Retro, do not answer this with your French fluency.
Elephant ears.
When's the last time you had one of those?
Never. Not since the Dutch Amish fair in Pennsylvania.
Which was probably a while back. No, we were looking for casserole. Casserole.
Whatever.
Your fourth question.
Casserole is not a saute pan.
A saucepan.
A saucepan. Different.
Mm-hmm.
Would you call it a casserole?
Yeah.
Really?
Saucepan is deep, so like it's like a casserole. That's what we call it in French. In casserole.
We're checking our
fact checker.
Our fact checker over here who would know.
I don't mind being crushed
Are
by
you
Janet.
Ready? Are you ready for your fourth question? You can't import beluga caviar to the U.S. because it's an endangered species of what fish that all caviar comes
sturgeon.
From?
Sturgeon.
That's right, sturgeon. They're delicious, delicious eggs. Mm-hmm. And your fifth question, what non-extinct animal lays the largest eggs?
Ostrich.
Yes. They're so big
Not
and creepy.
Not the emu, because that's
ooh,
extinct.
4 out of 5. Looks like somebody's going
loser.
To branch. Somebody's
that's
going
right.
to branch at Luke.
That is right. Michael Johnson.
Michael, we're going to see you at Luke on Saturday or Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a note, geeks who drink are the ones who gave us those questions. We appreciate that. Look for them and their trivia parties at our joints around town. If you want to be part of our show, you can send us a note on Facebook or Twitter at Seattle Kitchen. You're listening to us on Cairo Radio 97.3 FM. The show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media. Our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz, and our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. This show is produced by Tina Noll at Large Media, and our associate producer is Sarah Leibovitz. Our sound engineer is Sean Don't Call Me Del Torre. If you'd like to be part of this studio audience, go to hotstovesociety.com and buy tickets for only $15. And remember, if you miss any episode of Seattle Kitchen, you can subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher, Apple Podcast, or download the Cairo Radio app and search for Seattle Kitchen.
Thanks for listening.
Have a great weekend.
All right, Barbara Laban.